Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 30th of December, and we have moved to a new studio. So bear with me. I think everything is fine, but you know how it is. You're driving a car and all of a sudden you get a stick shift or something and things are just a wee bit different. So I think everything's going to work out A-OK. We have a big issue the first hour of our program, and this is something that caught our attention in the December 26 issue of the New York Times. The article is titled, Chinese Savings Helped Inflate American Bubble. And also an interesting article on December 23rd, Clinton moves to widen role of State Department. Mark Landler is joining us this hour, economic and diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. Mark has reported for the Times from 40 countries on four continents, including 5 years as chief of the Hong Kong Bureau. He's worked as a reporter and editor at Business Week magazine, and we'll be talking about the growing tendency of Americans to borrow from foreigners, particularly from the Chinese, to finance their heavy spending. And we'll be welcoming your phone calls as well. Our number remains the same. It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you'll be able to do that at talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. Mark, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Let's get a little history here to start with. When did the United States, Americans start to borrow heavily from foreigners, particularly from the Chinese? When and why?
Well, America has been borrowing from foreign countries for a long time. It's not a new trend. In fact, you could argue that the earliest incidences of borrowing go back well into our history, and one of the most notable examples was in the late 19th century, where we borrowed from the British to build the railroads, and that was a very good example of how foreign investment was used. By the way, I apologize. They're testing a fire alarm in my office, so if you hear a ringing in the background, that's what it is.
Okay.
And I hope it will only last a minute or two.
I'm glad it's just a test, Mark.
It's just a
that's
test.
That's good.
Yeah.
Okay.
But at any rate, there's a long history of borrowing from foreign countries, in the more recent time, in the 80s, we borrowed some from the Japanese during a period of time that we were running a heavy trade deficit with Japan. This most recent round of heavy borrowing from the Chinese, you can date back to the late 90s. We of course, have been running a very, very heavy trade deficit with China starting in the early part of this decade and really accelerating from 2003 through 2005. As the Chinese have been piling up this heavy trade surplus with the U.S., they've had an enormous reservoir of excess cash that they've needed to invest somewhere. And the investment of choice for them has been dollar-based assets, whether that be treasury bonds and bills or the debt issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They have steered the bulk of their very, very large store of earnings, of foreign earnings, into dollar-denominated assets. And so what we have is, a trend that really began in the early part of the 2000s but accelerated over the last couple of years.
And in order for us to take care of this $700 billion financial bailout, in order for us to have this huge economic stimulus package that the new administration is going to be giving us, we're depending on the Chinese to help us more?
We will. We will depend on the Chinese, and we'll also depend on anyone else who buys our government debt. The way it works, very simply, is that the Treasury Department has to issue new debt in order to finance a lot of the programs that are underway already, the financial rescue, which is a $700 billion package, and the Obama administration's prospective stimulus package, which, as some people have said, could be another $675 to $775 billion. These programs are generally financed through the issuance of government debt. The total U.S. public debt at the moment stands at about $10.6 trillion, and a chunk of it is held by foreign governments. And of those foreign governments, China is the largest holder of U.S. public debt. followed by Japan. Japan historically was the largest owner of U.S. debt for a long time, and in the last year, the Chinese took over that position. And in addition to the treasury bonds and notes that they hold, they also hold debt in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, a lot of debt. So their position in our U.S. public debt has grown a lot in the last few years, and economists sort of question in the long run whether that's either healthy or sustainable.
Mm-hmm. What would happen if China, for whatever reason, and tell me what those reasons might be, decided that they wanted to withdraw their money? Wouldn't that create total chaos?
It would, although most economists will quickly tell you that that's unlikely. It's unlikely for a couple of reasons. One is the simple scarcity of other obvious things to put the money into. The reason that people gravitate toward treasury bills and other government-backed debt in the United States is because it does have the highest possible credit rating. It has the full faith and credit of the United States government standing behind it. And there's very few very little debt around the world that you can buy that has that level of security attached to it. The second obvious point that people raise is that were China to try to move out of U.S. debt in any large-scale way or suddenly, it would cause such chaos in the value of that debt and in financial markets that it would badly hurt its remaining holdings in American debt, so that the people who would suffer would be the Chinese themselves. So there's a tremendous incentive, both because of lack of alternatives and the desire to keep the market stable at a reasonably high level, that would militate against the Chinese doing something like that.
But do they, considering, and tell me how bad the situation is, they're suffering a bit from are not being able to buy as many of their products. And from your article, I understand that they've been able to invest in our country mostly their earnings from manufacturing exports. If those go down, are they not able to give us less money for American government bonds?
The answer to that is yes. I mean, as their exports drop and as their revenue from exports drop, they will accumulate foreign exchange reserves at a slower pace than they were in the last 5 years, which means they'll have less to invest. So that there will be over time, a gradual diminishment of their investment, which will be less a function of a deliberate decision to steer away from the U.S. than the fact that they'll be piling up a smaller storehouse of reserves. So I think that we will see that. I mean, I should add as a note that the Chinese Sovereign Wealth Fund, CIC, which is sort of a quasi-government entity and also has a large amount of money to invest, they have said that there are certain types of U.S. investments that they are less interested in than they were a few years ago. One is financial institutions. They simply are less interested in investing in U.S. banks. So there will be some reallocation of investment, but I just want to stress that that's not going to be an abrupt or massive shift. It's going to be done gradually. And as I said earlier, they will have less to invest in total. So we'll have to rely on others, our own domestic investment, other countries. And there's been no shortage of demand, I should say, that treasury bills have a yield now that's close to zero, which shows the sort of the intensity of interest in owning those securities at a time of uncertainty in the global economy. People do tend to turn to treasury bonds because they're seen as a very safe investment. So there is a huge amount of demand at the moment. The problem the government has is not one of finding people to take our debt. That is not one of our problems.
Mm-hmm. And what about the products that are coming out of China? Is there still a huge demand from America for cheap imports? And if so, is that changing? And what are those imports that we just gobble up?
Well, it is changing because demand, consumer demand in the United States is dropping at a precipitous rate. The types of things we consume from China are what you would expect, electronics, shoes, toys, these types of things. Over time, as low-cost labor has moved from China to other places in South Asia and Southeast Asia, we consume different things. We probably don't consume as many T-shirts from China as we used to. China, like every economy, is moving up the value chain and attempting to make more sophisticated and higher value-added products. So, you know, at the moment, we probably consume a lot of electronics, and over time, the types of products we would consume will grow more sophisticated, but against a backdrop of generally slackening demand. American consumers, for the first time in years, are now consuming less than they did this time last year, and that's hitting the Chinese extremely hard.
Mm. And is part of the problem the way we use their investment? You talk about buying SUVs, about going into Iraq and spending a lot of the money on questionable things.
Well, this was the analogy that I drew to the building of the railroads in the late 19th century. During that time, we took foreign capital, largely from the British, and we poured it into a very important infrastructure project that opened up the country and connected the country. This time around, I don't want to suggest that we squandered everything that we took in, but what the low-cost investment capital from China did was enable a low interest rate environment, an easy money environment, and that money, in many cases, went into consumer products, a lot of real estate speculation, no money down mortgages. You can't say China's responsible for all of that, mm-hmm. but the Chinese, the dynamic that the Chinese helped create, allowed some of this to take hold. And so, you know, that then in turn led to some of the exotic financial instruments that we've heard a lot about in the last few months, that in turn led to the subprime crisis. So, you know, there's a chain of events where if you trace it back to its sources, you find that the Chinese money played a role in that.
And what have the Chinese, Mark, done with all the money they've received from us?
Well, the Chinese, and this is where this notion of the global savings glut comes into the discussion. The Chinese have, as much as Americans have tended to spend over the last decade, Chinese have tended to save. There are a lot of reasons for that. One of them is that as China has moved from a state-controlled economy to more of a market economy, they've lost a lot of social the social safety net has become frayed, and Chinese have entered into what economists call precautionary savings. They tend to save at an unusually high rate because they're worried about the future. They're worried about who's going to pay for their health care. They're worried about paying for their retirement. They don't have a sort of a sense of social stability, and so Chinese households, the Chinese government, they tend to save very heavily, and this is part of the dynamic that leads to the heavy investment in the U.S., because as they pile up these enormous savings, they're looking for places to put the money. They don't just keep it, you know, in a proverbial, stashed under their mattress. They are looking for places to put it. And some economists, including Ben Bernanke, who is the current chairman of the Federal Reserve, have argued that this very high rate of savings in countries like China, but not limited to China. There are other Asian countries that save heavily. And during the period of time that oil was trading at a very expensive rate, a lot of the oil-producing countries were also racking up heavy savings. He was arguing that this heavy rate of savings helps account for these huge imbalances between the Chinese and the U.S., precisely because they have such an enormous amount of savings, they need somewhere to put it. The place they put it is the United States, and that in turn feeds the problems that we've had with too much credit and too much spending.
Interesting. So they save and we spend.
Precisely.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls for Mark. Here's our number, and it is 1-800-486-8655. All of our lines are open, and give us a ring in our new studio so we make sure that you're there. We're talking this hour of the program with Mark Landler, who's an economic and diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. And our conversation today prompted by an article on December 26th, which maybe you saw, of the Times, Chinese savings helped inflate the American bubble. So we're looking at the investment that China has in the United States and the fact that they are saving and we are spending. All of this is changing a little bit now, but we're also looking to them for increased financing of the $700 billion, I always want to say million, but it's billion dollars for the financial bailout and also more investment for an economic stimulus here in this country with the new administration. So join us. 800-486-8655 is the number for you to call. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Tuesday, we'll be talking about the future of space exploration in the United States with our guest, the executive director of the Planetary Society. And we'll also be speaking with a professor in the Stanford University Department of Aeronautics and the Carl Sagan Chair for the Study of Life in the Universe at the SETI Institute. All right, our phones are jammed now for Mark. Our number, eventually you'll be able to get through, is 800-486-8655. And we start our calls with Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
Hope you had a good Christmas.
Thanks, Frank. And you too.
Would I be able to make what I think is a salient point, which is that the trade imbalance and the accumulation of surpluses in China sort of led to the great moderation and the low interest rates, which subsequently led to this search for yield, which is part of the background to all that financial speculation and those strange derivatives and so on. And that this was an unhealthy situation was pointed out over a period of at least 5 years, that people were behaving as if risk didn't exist. So thank you for your guest, and to both of you and the audience, have a good New Year.
Yeah, you too, Frank. Bye. Thank you. Mark.
Frank, you make a very, very important point, and it's actually a central point of the article that I wrote, which is indeed that the low interest environment was in some ways, in some large way, a product of this inflow of capital from the Chinese. In addition to the Great Moderation, which is one of the ways that people have referred to this era, there's something else that I'm sure you're aware of that Alan Greenspan often talked about, which was the conundrum. He wrote about it in his book. And the conundrum for Alan Greenspan was that long-term interest rates no longer seem to be responding much to the Fed funds rate, to the rate set by the Federal Reserve. And he sent a memo out to his economists sometime in the middle of the decade asking for explanations of why this would be. And one of the explanations, perhaps the most important explanation, was in fact the depressive effect on interest rates of the Chinese capital. And indeed, as interest rates went down and the yields went down on all sorts of investments, that drove investors and banks to search for yield. And that was the most important source of fuel for derivatives, for securitized investments, for collateralized debt obligations, all of these arcane terms that we didn't even really know about a year ago. And within those financial instruments were many of the toxic elements that exploded in the subprime crisis. So, and you know, one of the points I want to make, because in the reaction to the story and on the internet and in email, a number of readers wrote in to say, well, you're blaming the Chinese, or why are you blaming the Chinese? And I guess the answer is we're not blaming the Chinese. The Chinese aren't responsible. But they do play a role in a chain of events. And the fatal error, if you want to argue there was one on the American side, was in what use we made of this capital, and also, and this is a very important point, in the lack of regulation and oversight over the financial markets. And in the interview that I did with Ben Bernanke on this topic, as he looked back, he didn't say he would have behave differently in terms of setting interest rates or monetary policy. That, by the way, is a debatable point. Other economists would argue that the Fed should have done something different. But he did say in the area of regulation that it's a regret of his that we didn't recognize the abuses and the excesses that were being built up as a result of this very low interest rate environment and have acted more strongly to prevent these types of things from spinning out of control.
Yeah, tell me more about that. You say that he says that the Fed's role in regulation limited to banks and stricter regulation by itself would not have been enough.
He's arguing that look, we could have remedied some of this. We could have stopped some of the abuses. Maybe we could have stopped some of the predatory lending. We might have had closer oversight over many of these untransparent markets in credit default swaps and other things. But he's saying that if you want to really go to the root cause of the problem, which is this massive imbalance in capital flows, that you can't do that simply by addressing regulation. You've got to get the countries where the savings glut, where the storehouse of savings are being piled up, to change their behavior as well. And in 2006, Ben Bernanke went to China with an American delegation, and he gave a very a speech that drew a lot of attention in China at the time. And his argument was to the Chinese, look, it's in your own long-term interest to kickstart domestic consumption, to get your own people to start spending, because then you'll be less reliant on exports, less vulnerable to a downturn in foreign markets, your own monetary policy, your own central bank will be able to influence things better if you have a more balanced flow of capital on your side, not just on the American side. He gave this speech at the end of 2006. It was not the first time the Chinese had heard this. American officials have been going to China for at least 5 years and telling any senior official who would listen that this was important. To their credit, they tried also with government programs to stimulate domestic consumption. They weren't very successful. And now they find themselves on the flip side of the coin from where we are. They're dealing with having lost a major export market, their largest and most important market, the United States, which has now tumbled into recession. So their export growth has fallen off a cliff. Consumers are still not spending in China at anywhere the rate they need to. So they're dealing now with the fallout from their own imbalanced growth, just as we are on our side. It's a very different economic crisis right that they face. But in some ways, it's no less serious than the one we're contending with.
Let's go to Mike from Madison next. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Haley. Thank you. Great guest. Got two things. One, my observation would be that an awful lot of this was fueled by, one, rewarding short-term behavior, and two, deregulation. But kind of on a broader note, I'm concerned about our long-term trade imbalance with China, which, despite all predictions, has just grown and grown, and which is really destroying much of our manufacturing base in this country. And again, I think that short-term, we have this comparative advantage notion, we get cheap goods. But long-term, I think it's incredibly destructive to the American economy. So I'm interested in what your guest has to say.
All right, Mike.
Well, certainly, Mike, there's a lot of people that argue that point, that, you know, we should have invested in our manufacturing sector during this period and that we are paying the price. And if you look at the bailout of General Motors and Chrysler, you could argue that there's some evidence of that legacy in what's happening there. On the other side of that argument, the more economic determinists will say, the U.S. did what it was supposed to do during this period. It transformed itself into a services-dominated economy, and some forms of manufacturing will inevitably go to lower-cost
markets, and that's all in the proper scheme of things. So it's not a settled point. You'll hear both sides of the argument. You know, there's no question that we left ourselves vulnerable, but you know, by the same token, you could argue there's no question the Chinese left themselves vulnerable. And it's interesting, that same debate is now taking hold in China, because they're some of the manufacturing that took hold in the southern provinces in Guangdong and other places is now moving from China to Bangladesh and Vietnam. And I think one of the fascinating things, it's probably a bit early to see this, but I think the Chinese will end up having the same debate over their manufacturing industry as we move forward and they move up the value chain and they begin to lose manufacturing to other countries, not so much T-shirt factories, to be sure. I don't think anyone necessarily regrets that they move out of the market. But even you're even seeing some basic manufacturing leaving China and going to cheaper markets in Asia.
Thanks for your call. Let's go to Lyle from Eau Claire next. Hi, Lyle.
Good morning.
Hi.
I've always had, well, first of all, I don't understand the currency exchange between the different countries. But I've also always wondered, if we're buying the Chinese goods with American dollars and they're left with the dollars, doesn't that require them to sooner or later spend them in the U.S.?
Well, yeah, it does. And in fact, that's what they do. They reinvest. They plow the dollars back into U.S. government debt, not exclusively, but primarily. And so that's how the cycle works. They sell us their products. We give them our dollars. They recycle those dollars into our government debt. Then there's a second thing that happens, which is that in order to keep their currency at an artificially low rate against the dollar, they need to buy up their own currency in the open market. And in doing that, they buy more dollars. So in addition to the pure dollars they're getting from selling us things, they're also converting a lot of their own currency into dollars to maintain the exchange rate of their dollars, of their currency. And that gives them these enormous foreign exchange reserves. In the year 2000, China had a foreign exchange fund of roughly $200 billion, which was a lot.
Yeah.
Now, 5 years later, they have a fund that exceeds $2 trillion.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's an extraordinary amount of money, and they have to plow it into something. They have to figure out what to do with it. And it's very difficult to get precise estimates, but most people think that roughly 60 or 70% of the total amount of that they hold in foreign exchange, in other words, money that's not their own currency, they put into dollar-denominated assets. That, as I said earlier, would be treasury notes and treasury bonds, and also debt issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And one sort of parenthetical note on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. If you remember months ago when there was when those two institutions fell into trouble and the government was interceding and there was a debate over whether the government should simply take over Fannie and Freddie, one of the foreign actors in this drama was the Chinese government and the Chinese central bank, because they are very major holders, you know, maybe $200-300 billion worth of that debt. And so they were on the phone with the Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, saying, you know, you guys got to take care of this. And he spent a lot of time on the phone with the Chinese and with other countries, not just the Chinese, assuring them that this debt would be protected and the value of it would be protected. And one of the arguments that some people have made is that a downside of allowing foreigners to, or a downside of having so much of our debt in the hands of foreigners and foreign governments, is that it makes us in some way, I don't want to say beholden, that's too strong a word, but that they have some leverage over us. And in the bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you saw a bit of that leverage in action.
Thanks very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. And our guest this hour is Mark Landler. He's economic and diplomatic correspondent for The New York Times. And we're talking this hour about the economic relationship between China and the United States in its many facets, and welcoming your phone calls. Thanks for the call, Lyle. We go to Jim next from Platteville. Hi, Jim.
Yes. Recently, I've been reading quite a bit about bartering, and especially with countries that are having financial problems. I was just curious to know if Mark would have any comment on that, and I'll just hang up and listen to the radio.
All right.
You know, I don't, honestly. I've read a bit about bartering, as you have. It was not something that really came up in the course of reporting this story. I don't sense that it's a major part of our relationship with China. So while I'm interested like you are, I'm afraid I don't know a great deal about it.
Let's talk a little bit about tariffs. Ironically, I believe you had this conversation as he was shopping for Christmas in a Walmart store. Lindsey Graham and his thoughts about tariffs and pushing legislation to punish China by imposing stiff tariffs.
Well, yeah, Lindsey Graham was part of a long debate in Washington over what to do about the trade deficit. And part of the point of this article was to explore how the relationship evolved between the U.S. and China and what steps Washington took. Were they adequate? Were they the right steps or the wrong steps? And Lindsey Graham, along with Chuck Schumer, who's the Democrat from New York, introduced, I think it was the first piece of legislation in 2003, which essentially threatened to impose a 27% tariff on Chinese imports if the Chinese didn't allow their currency to trade more on a market level against the dollar. Remember, I said that the Chinese do this very heavy intervention into the currency market to keep their currency artificially depressed. And many people in the U.S., most economists agree, that our trade deficit with China is worse than it otherwise would be because the currency is artificially depressed. It makes Chinese goods cheaper in the United States than they would otherwise be. So Lindsey Graham, along with Chuck Schumer, started this effort. And over a period of 3 or 4 years, there were something like 36 different bills introduced in the Senate and the House, all aimed at pressuring the Chinese on the currency. Some were quite draconian, like this tariff. Others were a little bit more nuanced. And most people agree that they had an effect. The Chinese had resisted the idea of allowing the currency to move at all for many years. But in late 2004, they began debating the issue internally within their own central bank. And in July of 2005, they actually took the first step in allowing their currency to trade a little bit more freely against the dollar. It had been fixed against the dollar at a rate of 8.2 to the dollar for a decade or so. And in July 2005, they allowed it to move a little bit. And when I say little, I mean little. It was something like it rose in value by 2.2%. And then over the next couple of years, it rose more significantly by upwards of 20% against the dollar. Most people don't believe it reached a market level, in other words, where it would have landed if it were allowed to really trade freely. But these various steps and bills in Congress were seen as one of the things the Chinese responded to because they recognized the danger that if they did nothing, and there was a real heavy protectionist backlash against the U.S., that would hurt them much more than allowing a modest appreciation in the value of their currency. So Lindsey Graham was looking back on that whole experience when I interviewed him. It was a pure coincidence that he was talking to me on his cell phone from a Walmart.
No.
And actually a little note on that, as we were talking, I asked him to walk down the aisles and you know turn over a few of the products and tell me where they were made, and he said, well, I'm seeing more made in Bangladesh and more made in Vietnam than made in China, so maybe that shift of real low cost manufacturing out of China is already underway. But he was also sort of talking a little bit about whether he felt that in the end that effort had been useful or not. And I think he felt that it had, insofar as it did get the Chinese to move off the mark a little bit. But I think we all agree, not enough, and the trade deficit really never declined. I think it will now decline, but for probably the wrong reasons, which is that American consumers aren't buying anything. I mean, right. the consumption in the U.S. has plummeted. I think you probably would have liked to see another reason for the trade surplus with China to come down a little bit, rather than a deep recession in the U.S. But that looks like how it's going to play out.
Mark Landler is our guest, and we're talking with him about the economic relationship between the United States and China. He's an economic and diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. Our phone number, our lines are crowded right now, but I hope you can get through in the next 20 minutes. 800-486-8655 is the number, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Tuesday, should we be going to Mars? And the future of space exploration. Back to your phone calls. Matt is next from Middleton. Hi, Matt. Hi, Matt. You there? Well, let's try. Ken. Hi, Ken from Milton. Hi.
Hello. I'd like to see a diagram of what actually happened. Because my thinking is that the Chinese did not stop accepting our money. To have a metaphor, we put like three or four rotten apples in a shipload, these defaults, and we told them that the shipload of apples is perfect. But they found out that there were three or four defaults, rotten apples in these packages we sold them, and they said, "No, we're not going to take this anymore. This money anymore." Is what set this off, and then the Chinese went for the government U.S. government guaranteed money. But can you draw a diagram of what was the first step in this problem?
Well, I would go back to the basic trade relationship first. I mean, I think there was a decision on the Chinese side at the highest levels of government that they wanted to develop their economy through exports. And as that developed, the most hungry export market was the United States, and they geared their economy around that. I don't think the initial decision in China was a decision on investing capital. I think it was a decision on fueling economic growth through exports. They did make, at that time, decisions that also had bearing on capital and capital flows. The two decisions they made were, one, as I said earlier, the one to fix their currency to the U.S. dollar at a certain rate and use central bank intervention to maintain that exchange rate. And the second decision they made was to accumulate foreign exchange reserves. The reason they did that was partly a reaction to the Asian financial crisis. Back in the late 90s, several other Asian countries, Thailand, Korea, Indonesia, which were also export-driven economies, ran into terrible trouble when their currencies came under attack from speculation, and they were forced to devalue their currencies, and they wound up not being able to defend their currencies because they didn't have foreign exchange reserves. The Chinese looked at that and decided they didn't want to be vulnerable to that kind of pressure should there be a financial crisis in the future. And so they made this deliberate decision to build up an enormous storehouse of foreign exchange reserves. So you have to sort of think of it not as one thing leads to the next. There were two different decisions made in the late 90s. One was to fuel growth through exports. The other was to keep a fixed exchange rate and build up these reserves. Then, having
begun to accumulate the reserves, the decision they faced was where to put the money. You're right to say that they didn't just put it into Treasury bonds. They also invested in corporate debt. They invested in financial institutions in the United States. There are large private sector investments, and like any investor in those, they have been hurt. They've seen the value of those holdings plummet. And as they have, I'm sure, tended to steer more of their investment into stuff that had either an implicit or an explicit government guarantee. So there's definitely an evolution in their thinking about where they invest the money. But I still think that, to go back, if you were sort of thinking in terms of a diagram, and by the way, with our article, there was a four-part graphic that if you go onto www.nytimes.com and find a series called the Reckoning series and call up this particular article, you'll find this graphic, and it does attempt to show you the steps, you know, how the trade surplus led to an accumulation of foreign exchange reserves, which were then poured into the U.S., which depressed our interest rates, which contributed to consumption in the U.S. And that's kind of the chain of events as we've laid it out in the article.
Thanks very much for the call. Let me ask you a rather large question, but you're in the business, Mark. What do you think it's going to take for us, and by us, I guess, I mean most of the countries on Earth, to get out of this economic mess? How bad will it get? How are we going to recover?
Well, I'm only going to cite some of the economists I spoke to for the story, because I don't pretend to know. I'm not sure anyone thought could have foreseen this, you know, the severity of this. Some of the leading economists think that you know, this is going to be very protracted and very deep, and will be the worst in severity since the Great Depression. And you know, some people point out that the recession in the early 1970s was pretty rough too. There was also a very bad one in the early 80s, when right after Reagan took over. There seems to be a belief that this one could be worse than both of those. And some people have said that if you look at the type of crisis that we're in, it has more in common with the 1930s than it does with the 1970s or the 1980s. It's not a supply shock like in the 70s, where oil prices went through the roof. It's in fact an across-the-board financial crisis, which is exactly what we had in the 1930s. So that's one observation. The other observation is that there was a lot of talk in the last 2 years about how emerging markets, places like China, the Gulf, other parts of Asia, would provide a growth engine, so that even if Europe and the United States both fell into recession, we could count on these emerging markets to pull us out. What's troubling about China in the last month is that the collapse of exports, the lack of domestic demand, the very, you know, sharp slowdown in their growth suggests that they may not be a growth engine after all. And so we may face a couple of years where there's no growth engine. We have an economy that's stalled in the U.S., stagnating at best, if not contracting. In Europe, the outlook is just as negative as it is in the United States. The oil-producing countries are struggling with the fact that oil prices have plummeted, and the Chinese are dealing with this collapse in exports. So if you look across the board, you don't actually see an impulse. And some economists have said to me that suggests that we could be facing at least a tough 2009, but maybe even a tough 2010. There is a school of thought that says we'll start to recover by 2010. Some of the pessimistic voices say, well, maybe not even until 2010 or 2011, because we don't have this obvious impulse that's going to pick us up.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Matt now from Middleton. Hi, Matt.
Good morning. I'm wondering if the downturn in consumer purchasing and spending in the United States is strictly related to Chinese products, and if it's restricted to a certain class of products, or if higher value, higher quality products, say made in Europe, or products that come in from South America, are having the same types of problems as what I consider a lot of junk and non-essential products that come in from China.
Well, Matt, I'm not an expert on sort of the retail business, and in a way, probably we'll have a sense for that when we get a full download on how Christmas sales went. But my sense is that consumer spending in the U.S. is dropping across the board, and I don't think it's just a function of households not buying the junk from China. I think it's actually broader than that. I think people are putting off purchases of big ticket items. They're not buying cars at the rate they were. They're not buying luxury goods, and so to that extent, I would imagine it's hitting the Europeans and the Latin Americans. I was based in Germany prior to coming back to the U.S. last summer, and I know that the German car makers are also suffering and that their American markets are plunging. So my sense is it's across the board. It certainly does hit the Chinese very hard, but I don't think it's limited to them.
Thank you, Matt, for your call. We go to Chris next from Cottage Grove. Hi, Chris.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
All right. How are you?
Great, thank you. Say, I just had two quick questions. Earlier, you were discussing how the Chinese economy is so heavily linked to the dollar, and the question that I have is, how big of a concern is it if OPEC were to change the sales of oil from, say, using the dollar currency to something else, and how big of a deal is it if the American dollar collapses to the Chinese government?
Well, it's interesting you should mention that, because there had been a school of thought for several years that the relationship between the U.S. and China was unsustainable, but not for the reasons that ended up happening in the last 2 to 3 months. The thesis was that there'd be a collapse in the dollar, and that would be brought about by the Chinese abruptly dumping their holdings of U.S. government debt, and that would lead to this dramatic devaluation in the dollar, and that in some ways the relationship would end in a crash of the dollar. Now, when you talk about OPEC countries breaking their link to the dollar, that feeds into the same idea. The idea was that the dollar was due for a major, major correction. Interestingly enough, in the early going of this financial crisis, that actually hasn't happened. And in fact, the opposite happened for the first 2 to 3 months of crisis, which was that as investors flooded into U.S. securities, mostly treasuries, it actually drove up the value of the dollar for a brief period against the yen, against the euro. And the dollar was looking quite strong, and several economists made the observation that in a world of turbulence and uncertainty, the dollar still benefits. It still actually shows its status as the default currency for the world. Now, in the last month, you've started to see that reverse again, and as the depth of the recession in the U.S. has become clear, the dollar has begun sliding again. But what we haven't yet seen, and so the proposition has never been tested, is whether the dollar status as that default currency will really come under challenge. OPEC, after a few people, the Venezuelans and the Iranians, made some comments about breaking the link, they haven't really seriously thought about it. Likewise, a lot of governments that have heavy dollar holdings have talked a little bit about reallocating more of it to euros, but they really haven't done more than work on the margins, and neither have the Chinese. So that issue's out there. Some people, like Alan Greenspan, still believe there could be a sharper devaluation of the dollar over time, but we haven't reached that point yet. And we, some people would have thought we would be there already, and the fact that we're not is causing even economists who follow this day and night to be kind of puzzled. You know, they sort of wonder why we haven't had this happen yet. And no one has a very good answer. So that's one of the kind of imponderables that's still out there.
There is so much for this new administration to do, isn't there?
It's extraordinary. I mean, and we've only talked about macroeconomics and capital flows and things like that. I mean, we haven't even touched on the troubles in Gaza, the diplomatic portfolio for the new Secretary of State, which is also going to be extraordinary. It's quite an amazing challenge that they face.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it will be a really hard year, Mark, 2009?
I do. I think it'll be a very hard year. I think the only thing you could say for the Obama administration is that they will have extraordinary leeway. There's been a very big change in economic thinking. There's now a consensus that you need to spend heavily to get out of this problem. You remember the fatal mistake that the government made during the Depression was trying to be austere and have a policy of austerity, mm-hmm. even as the economy was falling through the floor. Everyone agrees we're not going to do that this time. So we're going to spend what it takes to cushion the blow and stimulate the economy. And I think that that's one area where the Obama administration will have a lot of leeway. They've got a very high-powered economic team in Tim Geithner, the new Treasury Secretary-designate, and Larry Summers, who's going to be the chief White House advisor on economics. These guys understand the crisis, and they're top-class guys. So I think that we will have a very rough year, but they've got a good team and a lot of room to maneuver.
Mm-hmm. Mark, thank you so much. What an informative hour this has been. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Kathleen.
Mark Landler is economic and diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. We guide you to the article that he wrote on December 26, Chinese Savings Helped Inflate American Bubble. And that was all that we can handle this hour. There's also an article that I hoped we would get to, but we'll talk about this later. Clinton moves to widen the role of State Department. Perhaps you had a chance to read both of those. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production in our new studios here. We have moved over the course of the past week to the Royce Federal Building in downtown Milwaukee, so we're just getting used to our new digs. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with more Tuesday morning conversation. And stay with us, because it's another of our favorite topics, which is space exploration. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 10, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.